Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. We have a lot to cover on tonight's show. We'll hear from East Bay Congressman and former presidential candidate Eric Swalwell about protecting our elections, including our right to vote by mail, providing COVID relief, and his work with the House during the presidency of Donald Trump. Towards the end of the hour, guest contributor Sara Ladipo Manyika will be talking to Bay Area comedian Zara Nourbash about finding the funny in unfunny times. But first, we continue our ongoing coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic with San Francisco Chronicle health reporter Aaron Alday and UCSF infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Chin Hong. We have been regularly featuring Aaron and Peter at the top of the hour throughout the crisis. If you have any COVID-related questions you would like us to ask them, email us now or anytime throughout the week at cityvisions@kalw.org, and we will try to get Aaron and Peter to respond on the air. So welcome back, Aaron.
Thanks for having me back.
Hey,
welcome
guys.
Back, Peter.
Always a pleasure.
It's been another tumultuous week on the COVID-19 front, hasn't it, Aaron?
It's always tumultuous. Like never boring, for sure. Yes.
So give us the highlights.
Well, you know, the last week, I mean, I will actually say that given the roller coaster, as Peter rightfully said, this whole pandemic has been, last week was a tiny bit quieter, partly because we're in this sort of, you know, we were in actually this little frozen period because the state was dealing with this data glitch that caused a lot of cases to go unreported. And so for a week there, they literally kind of froze things while they kind of recalibrated, tried to get caught up with these cases, get them sorted out to where they belonged. And there's this this watch list that the state has to monitor counties that have been kind of seen especially bad surges in cases. And they actually froze that watch list so that nobody could come on or off of it for a week. So we actually had this kind of weird stasis that we were in. But, you know, there were plenty of other developments happening along the way, including losing our state health officer on Monday, a week ago Monday. And just, you know, the usual ups and downs.
And how are things looking across the Bay Area in terms of number of cases, hospitalizations, positive test rates?
So I think things are looking, you know, it does seem like we are coming off of a peak. So we're seeing now very clear signs that things are trending downward, which is exactly what we want to see. We're still way higher than anybody would like. But we're headed in the right direction. And there was some uncertainty because of that data glitch that we weren't entirely sure that what we were seeing was real. But now that they've resolved that, they've put those cases where they belong, we have pretty reliable information again. We are seeing that the trends are heading in the right direction. Hospitalizations are trending down. All of that's looking pretty good. The positive test rate is also looking trending downwards. The only thing that still is climbing a little bit are the deaths, which is awful, but also not unexpected. Whenever you have a big surge in cases, you would expect to see that the deaths would take a couple weeks to catch up to those surges. So it's what we're really seeing are these cases that were identified, you know, a few weeks ago. Some of those folks, unfortunately, are dying now.
And how about contact tracing? How have we been doing there?
I think that, you know, we're not doing great. We're getting a little bit better. A lot of the counties say that they are doing a large number of contact tracing on their cases, that they're reaching, you know, 80 to 90% of their cases. But, you know, it's sort of hit and miss as to what that means in terms of, you know, just because they make that phone call, not everybody wants to participate. Not people, you know, don't necessarily stay on the phone. They're not necessarily great at providing all the information that you know, public health officials ask for. I think we have a lot of work to do in terms of both building up that kind of workforce, which we've made a lot of progress there, but also building up that public trust, getting people to understand why this is important. And for a while in that surge, you know, it was just that chaotic just to stay on top of the cases and just to try to reach everyone. And now I think hopefully with the numbers falling down, we're going to be able to do a little bit more of that work in helping people understand why this is so important and really using contact tracing to keep these new infections from spiraling and causing kind of more transmission of disease.
So, Peter, I looked at some of the graphs in terms of how the county's curves are looking, and you know, it's not really a downslope. It's just sort of a gentle slide. How many more weeks of decreased cases is it going to take before we really see a dip that feels good?
You know, Pache, I'm such a half glass full kind of person, but even I'm a little bit worried. I was trying to think about the right descriptor for the graphs for you, even before you said it. And the only word that popped into my head was simmering. I think our hospitals are simmering now. They're not on coals with fire and, you know, toasted marshmallows, but they're simmering. And whenever you simmer, you could easily go back to that high fire. And I'm worried about that as you go into fall and influenza. And I'm hoping that we get at least a little dip before we go back up again, which will inevitably be the case with, you know, schools and influenza and respiratory virus season.
Help us with a little math here. We know with exponential increases, it's everything looks quiet. And then there's this, you know, astronomic surge. Does that work in the opposite direction too? Can there be like, it's like simmering, and then we fall off and go down precipitously in the desired direction?
I mean, I think it's more of a gradual decline, but maybe it'll be fun to hear what Erin has to say based on her knowledge of the previous curves that we've had. But there isn't like, you know, we can definitely go up like what happened in the tri-state area in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, where you have enough people in basically going off and setting off virus in a crowded area where everyone takes the subway. It's going to be some time before you kind of come down. You don't just all of a sudden jump off the cliff and go down. Unfortunately, I wish that were the case.
Okay. So Erin, I wanted to turn back to you. You had an article yesterday in the Chronicle that talks about the excitement and the promise of vaccines, two of which are being tested in the Bay Area in phase 3 trials, which is the phase immediately before it's rolled out to the general population. Tell us a little bit about those two trials and tell us about all of the unanswered questions of if these actually are good contenders, how are we going to get this vaccine to the people who need it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and complicated situation. It's kind of fascinating, kind of if you can distance yourself from the topic to talk about it and think about it. The status of the vaccines being tested is, so we've got, I think there's like six to eight vaccines worldwide that are being tested in these phase 3 trials, which, as you pointed out, is sort of the last phase before potential approval. I should say probably not before rollout. That's sort of a whole other question, but before they might get approved by the FDA. We've got two or three of these vaccines being tested in these large trials in the United States, including these two that are enrolling people in California and the Bay Area. And that's, I mean, considering how quickly this has all happened, that's really exciting. And people are super, you know, legitimately enthusiastic about the fact that we've got all these viable vaccines out there just a few months after even realizing this virus exists. So there's a lot of reasons to feel really excited and really hopeful about that. And the early trials, you know, have shown promising. They definitely, what we see is that these vaccines do show an immune response. They seem to like do what we want them to do in the human body. These phase 3 tests are critical because what they show ideally is, do these vaccines actually prevent people from getting COVID-19 and ideally from being infected with the coronavirus? And that's just something you can't know until you put it out in the wild and let people do their thing and see if they get infected or not. And as you might imagine, that takes a period of time. So we're not really going to have answers from these, even really early kind of hints of what to expect, for a few more months at least. But the key thing I think that people need to keep in mind is that these very early vaccines, as exciting as they are, they may not be the game changers on their own. These may not be huge home runs. They might be, you know, 50% effective. You know, they might be just sort of so-so, like kind of gray area vaccines. They may only help people in a certain age group. They may not help the people who are most at risk. There's a lot of kind of outstanding questions. And, you know, once we even have these vaccines out there, then figuring out how to roll them out, whether to roll them out. If you have a vaccine that's only 50% effective, do you want to invest all of your immunization dollars into that vaccine and give it to everybody? Or do you want to wait a little while and see if there's one around the corner that's a little bit better? And then you have to make those really hard decisions of who to prioritize, who gets it first. Do you give it to the people who are most likely to get sick and die? What if it doesn't work that well in them? Do you give it to the people who are essential workers, who are the ones who are getting infected? You know, there's people right now that are working on those questions. But the point is that there's a lot of work that goes into that. There's a lot of sort of planning. And then you have the distribution aspect. You have the question of how do you give it to people? Where do you give it to them? Do they get in their doctor's office? Do you want everybody going? You don't want everybody going to big, you know, clinics where they're going to crowd around and get in line to get their shot. So even figuring out that distribution plan is a big project. So we're looking at a massive public health effort that is going to be a big pain to roll out. And I think the key thing that people, what I tell people is, it's really exciting that we're looking at these vaccines, but we're honestly looking at pretty far into next year before we actually see a widespread immunization campaign, even if everything goes really well.
And it sounds like, you know, flu immunizations is going to be our test run for what it's going to be like once we get gold contenders, as you would say, Peter, in the vaccine world. I wanted to shift to a couple of things that were in the news in the last few days, coming out of UCSF, a drug cocktail trial, and also a new nose spray that is supposed to help kill the coronavirus. And these would be some things that could be rolled out before a vaccine to help get us, buy us some time. Tell us about those two.
Yeah, so first, I think the most tangible thing of those two things that you mentioned, Pache, is the new drug cocktail has been studied by the NIH and the new version of the adaptive trial. It's called ACT-3. It's kind of interesting. It is even called ACT-3. It's like there's an ACT-1 and ACT-2, and now there's ACT-3. So this trial is going to look at remdesivir, that everyone knows, the Gilead drug, the sort of, you know, silver medalist, as I put it, with another drug that has a lot of traction. It's kind of the darling of COVID drugs right now. It's called interferon beta. It's a multiple sclerosis drug. But the reason why it's the darling right now in COVID terms is because there's this trial in England, very small trial, but very promising, where they gave patients who were early hospitalized patients inhaled interferon beta, and they were 80% of these prevented progression if you got the drug to ICU or intubation, and you were twice as much as likely to recover. That's not the way it's being given in the US in this trial. Now it's subcutaneous, so under the skin. And so half the patients will get that. Everybody's getting remdesivir. Half the patients will get interferon beta and the other half will get placebo. The reason why interferon beta is also exciting is that you can imagine opening up the whole world of outpatient COVID study and treatment, not only with possibly inhaled or subcutaneous interferon, but with the inhaled version of remdesivir that Gilead is developing as well. So that's kind of the NIH trial. And then the Aerodabs, or that nanoparticle preventative therapy that's been developed at UCSF, tremendous potential, exciting. But it's really at the lab phase, so it has to go through all of the phase 1, phase 2, FDA clearance, and that takes a long time. So I think the way it will probably place itself in therapy, because I do believe it's kind of very exciting as a preventive measure. You put it in the nose, kind of like mupirocin for staph. You prevent the bombarding of viruses there. Is that it would probably be good for people who, for whatever reason, don't respond to the vaccine. There's another possibly therapy you can offer people in that case. By that time, hopefully we'll get FDA cleared.
Would the Aeronabs, the nose spray, be used for protection for people who have been exposed to somebody? Could it be used in that case?
I think, you know, it's interesting that you bring it up. So I can imagine lots of different scenarios in which it could be studied. It's so early that I think they're basically thinking of it as just prevention in general. People who haven't been exposed is kind of like a alternative to a vaccine rather than a precursor to the vaccine. Although, as Erin pointed out, if the vaccine takes a while to come maybe this FDA process and early studies will go ahead swimmingly, and then we may have this before. The other things you can give before vaccine, of course, is passive immunity, which is convalescent plasma. We think about it as therapy, but if you think about it in a spirit, you give it to somebody as kind of a passive vaccine, somebody else's antibodies that can last for 3 months. Maybe as we wait for the vaccine, people will be thinking about that more in that context.
Okay, so there seems to be a lot of study out there, but I think from hearing from the both of you tonight, it's optimism, but we can't take it quite yet to the bank because there's still a lot of hurdles that need to be cleared, and then the logistics on top of that. One last thing, Peter, before we go, a study came out last week saying that on average, people who've been infected and have recovered from COVID have antibodies for about 3 months after they're infected, after they recovered. And that may mean that people are susceptible to reinfection. Is that can we make that link just yet, or is it too soon to make that?
You know, the answer is going to be too soon, Pache. Otherwise, I'm going to talk about it in a few months. But I think the pearl I know in the last second that I have is that the antibodies may not be the only evidence that we have protection. And they're these T cell memory that some cells that some labs have claimed that could, you know, when you stimulate them, they show that they have response, even though the antibodies in the test show that you're negative.
So while you might not have antibodies circulating in your blood, there's kind of a stealth force that's kind of in the wings waiting should they see coronavirus again.
Potentially, again, too tantalizing to really act on in a practical sense, but
yeah, and perhaps next week we'll talk a little bit more about these preprint articles, which seem to be all the rage now, like getting details of studies out before they're peer-reviewed,
yeah,
and
I mean,
causing a lot of confusion.
When
and,
it comes to New England Journal, it's boring. You know, we've seen that, been that. We've seen press release. We've already seen preprint. It's like, you know, nice font doesn't do it for me, you know?
All right. Well, it's great to have the both of you here because you could tell us like what legitimately to get excited about, what to be concerned about, and sort of where to sort of rest in the middle, so to speak. So I want to thank, as always, Aaron Alday, a health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious diseases specialist at UCSF. And of course, we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, both of you.
Bye.
And next up, I talk with Congressman Eric Swalwell. This is City Visions. Stay with us. Welcome back to City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight is opening night of the Democratic National Convention, and Democrats are energized, but they're also mad. Over the weekend, the battle over the post office heated up. Frustrations over President Trump's claims that mail-in voting will lead to massive fraud and his refusal to agree to much-needed funding for the cash-strapped agency were aggravated by stories of how the new Postmaster General, a Trump loyalist, is making decisions that are further hobbling the agency. Here tonight to unpack the story and to discuss his work in the House and other political news is Congressman Eric Swalwell, who's been representing California's 15th district since 2012, including a large part of the East Bay. And prior to that, he was a prosecutor in the Alameda County DA's office for 7 years. He's been a staunch critic of President Trump throughout his term and recently published a book giving an inside account of the Trump impeachment. Welcome, Congressman Swalwell, to City Visions.
Thank you so much, Joseph, for having me on. And I have just over my shoulder here the convention. So I'm listening to you and watching what's happening on the
what time's Michelle on?
Not soon enough.
Not soon enough. Okay. Well, as always, I want to invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. If you have any questions for Congressman Swalwell, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So before we turn to the historic national convention, let's talk about what's going on with the post office. So it's been back and forth, volley between Democrats and Republicans about the role of the post office in playing a crucial role in this November's election. President Trump has said that he, you know, doesn't want to put any money into the post office, but then said if the Democrats are willing to negotiate with the Republicans, maybe he would consider doing that. What's your sense of what's going on here?
The president is trying to sabotage the mail because the mail is the connective tissue in this country. While there are decentralized election systems throughout our country, you know, county by county, the connective tissue is the United States Postal Service. So if you can cripple the delivery service, you may have a shot if you're Donald Trump. But otherwise, as we start the convention tonight, no president has seen his opponent this far ahead in a reelection. No president has faced the likelihood of facing criminal prosecution when he leaves office. And no president has run for reelection as an impeached president. So the incentive to cheat, I think, is a powerful one. And that's what we're up against. So what are we going to do, Joseph? Well, we're coming back to Congress this week. We're going to vote to fully fund the post office. We have a hearing a week from today with the Postmaster General. And we're going to continue to make sure the American people not only have awareness about what's going on, that the post office has funding that the Senate should pass, but also that everyone needs to have a plan beyond just mailing their ballot in. If the Postal Service is not functioning, know what step two or step three is if the president is successful in trying to get in your way of having your voice heard.
So a couple of follow-up questions there. So the House approves this funding, but what happens in the Senate? There isn't any sense that the Senate's going to come back anytime soon.
Well, stay loud, right? The Senate map is also expanding, and so they have a powerful incentive to act on behalf of their constituents whose prescription drugs and healthcare benefits and paychecks are being held up as this happens. And so as long as people continue to press upon Republican senators that we have to fund the post office, there should be no politics in this, you know, almost timeless American service. I believe that we can get a vote from Mitch McConnell, but we should not give up and we should not let him off the hook.
And what to this point that our president made about, well, if the Democrats are willing to compromise on further funding to help Americans deal with the aftermath of the coronavirus, that perhaps the post office funding is in play. Are the Democrats ready to negotiate with the president and the Republicans?
Joseph, over 3 months ago, you know, we passed the HEROES Act, which funds state and local deficits because of COVID, which provides hazard pay for healthcare workers. It extends unemployment insurance to the end of the year, also would expand the Paycheck Protection Plan benefits. So we laid out 3 months ago what our values are and our belief in governing. And all we really have received from the Senate Republicans who are divided and the president are grievances. We have a plan. They have grievances. And so the speaker stands ready. You know, she's not golfing at her country club on the weekends. She's at the Capitol waiting to negotiate and, you know, get the best deal for the American people. But the best deal that the only deal that we've really been countered with is to extend unemployment insurance for a week and hold the American people hostage week by week by week. And that's not fair. And so I hope that plan beats no plan, but certainly funding the post office and funding, you know, COVID benefits, you know, can happen. And we're ready to work with any Republican who wants to work with us.
So my understanding is that the proposal will be to approve $25 billion in emergency funding for the Postal Service. What would we get from that?
It would also allow overtime to be paid. It would also stop the decommissioning of mail sorting machines, over 600 decommissioned just recently. So we would get the certainty that we need, first and foremost, for essential items that are in the mail. 330,000 veterans receive prescription drugs from the VA every day, but also that our democracy would be sustained as well, that you could count on putting your ballot in the mail. And, you know, again, the Postal Service, it is called a service. It's not the postal business. And for all these complaints I hear, oh, well, they lose money. The military loses billions of dollars a year. It's not a business. The military is also a service. And so to suggest that the post office is supposed to be Google, I think is disingenuous.
And when you hear from Postmaster General Louis DeJoy in the coming week, what would you hope that he is asked, and what kind of answers are you hoping to hear from him?
You know, first, a promise and a pledge, a promise that, you know, Americans can count on the Postal Service to deliver, you know, essential mail, and a pledge that from now, at least until Election Day in the next administration, that there will be no further disruptions. I mean, yes, of course, we want to know what directives were given, you know, by a president who usually says the quiet parts out loud. You know, what directives have been given to essentially dismantle the post office, to weaponize it in a way that it helps the president in his reelection. We want to learn all of that, but most importantly, promise that the mail will be delivered, pledge that, you know, there will be no further disruptions.
And the question you mentioned a couple of times now, senior citizens and others who depend on the post office for their prescription drugs and their checks, whether it's Social Security or pension, how does it look when you look at this question, that there's a concern that President Trump is concerned that mail-in voting is somehow going to favor Democrats? There's a lot of senior citizens who perhaps may skew Republican, who may also choose to vote by mail because of a concern of the risk to themselves of going and voting at the polls. Do you think President Trump is somehow shooting himself in the foot here too?
I don't understand. It's so misguided, Joseph, because just earlier this year in Southern California, there was a special congressional election for a vacant seat, Republican versus Democratic candidate. It was a 100% mail-in ballot election, and the Republican won. And the president had been tweeting up until that election that the election result was going to be fraudulent because of the mail-in ballots, but he didn't make a peep after the Republican won. And so, again, it just seems so misguided that he is afraid that mail-in ballots could lead to his demise. So he would, I guess, accept the collateral damage that it would also be the demise of the healthcare of so many Americans and his own voters.
And before we move on, what's plan B if you can't get the Senate to approve this measure?
Great question. Plan B is to be, you know, as loud as possible, so Americans at least understand that the president is trying to sabotage the post office for an electoral advantage, and they will hold that against him. To also make sure that Americans have their own plan B for how they get their ballots counted, that if they cannot rely on the Postal Service to deliver them, what is the next, you know, option, whether it's dropping their ballot off at a secure ballot drop-off location, or if, God forbid, they would have to go to the polls and polling places have been collapsed, that it would be a long line, at least plan for it. But I am convinced that most Americans know what is at stake this election, and people really value in a democracy that, you know, your voice is heard and will, you know, crawl through glass, walk through fire to make sure that ballot is counted. But let's not get to plan B. Let's, you know, put all the pressure on the Republicans to fund plan A.
So moving on to the Democratic National Convention, which starts this evening, historic for many reasons. First, the first virtual convention, and secondly, the significance of Kamala Harris being the first Black woman and the first person of South Asian American descent, the first person who attended a historically Black college to be put up as a vice presidential candidate for a major party ticket. Tell me how you are looking at the week that's about to unfold for us, both in terms of the significance of how we got to this day and what you hope to see unfold in the days to come.
I'm so proud of Kamala Harris. We're both alums of the Alameda County District Attorney's Office. And I was talking to another alum of the office, who's a defense attorney now, earlier today. And he said to me, he said, Eric, you know, I'm not very political, but, you know, what gives me comfort about Kamala is that I know that she started in the Alameda County DA's office, an office that he goes up against every day as a defense attorney. And he said, I know in that office, you know, there's a core, there's a creed, and I know who she is because she was trained in that office. And the creed in that office is that we don't seek wins, we seek justice. And that has been her core from the DA's office in Alameda County to being the DA in San Francisco, to the Attorney General's office, to being a U.S. Senator of the largest state. I just see somebody, you know, who does seek justice. So, I mean, yes, she's historic, but she's also eminently qualified, and I think is just a terrific candidate.
And what's the message you hope comes out from this week, from both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, to the Democratic constituency and all the others that you're hoping for to show up to vote the Democratic ticket this fall?
Yeah, I would say two things: unity and vision. Unity in that not only, you know, do you have two rivals who are now a ticket in Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. Again, Kamala Harris's first job, prosecutor. Joe Biden's first job after law school, public defender. You know, it's unity in every way on that ticket. But tonight, as I watch the speakers, Governor Kasich, Meg Whitman, who ran, you know, in California statewide, you know, Christine Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey, you know, unity as far as Democrats and Republicans. So unity, I think, for the American people is the antidote to so much of, you know, the problems we have today. And vision in what will we do in the first, not 100 days, that's usually the amount of time a president is afforded to get things done, but what will we do in the first 100 hours, especially around COVID relief.
And let's stay a moment with Kamala. So you mentioned that you both served in the district attorney's office in Alameda County. And a lot of the criticism that has been leveled at her record while she was in law enforcement has to do with her involvement or lack thereof in certain cases, especially cases including killings by police during her tenure as Attorney General here in California. As a former prosecutor yourself, what do you make of the criticism that's been levied against her? Is it fair? What is your perspective doing this work bring to how you respond to her critics?
Yeah, I've never questioned her motive. Again, I believe her motives always come from a place of wanting, you know, to see justice done. I also believe that she is incredibly, incredibly open-minded. And you know, not to speak to any specific case, you know, I understand the criticism you're talking about, but that she is open-minded and has been a leader in the Senate on criminal justice reform, pre-sentencing with, you know, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which we passed in the House, and she would support if it was brought to a vote in the Senate, but also, you know, in sentencing reform that she worked with Cory Booker and others on, you know, to be signed into law. And, you know, I also, it's a tough job as a prosecutor, especially when your name is on, you know, the pleading, if you recall, right after she was elected, tragically, a police officer in San Francisco was killed, and she did not seek the death penalty. And, you know, she received criticism from law enforcement. So, you know, you have to make tough calls as a prosecutor, and I would never question her motives. I believe it's rooted in wanting to see justice done. But more important than that, she's open-minded, and I think you have seen that in her career.
Let's stay with the other part of the issues we've been tackling this summer around racial justice and police reform. You state in your bio very clearly that you're the son and a brother of two police officers. You've co-sponsored police reform legislation. Tell us how you're thinking about this. What conversations have you had with your family members? And what do you think about the defund movement of defunding police departments?
You know, I've seen the best of police. And to me, you know, law and order, being a law and order Democrat means that I believe that there's only one set of laws that we all have to follow and no one is above it, not even the president. I don't believe a law and order public office holder means that you would use chemical weapons on peaceful protesters. There's a difference in values there. But my brothers work very hard every day. One of them also works in the Deputy Sheriff Athletic League. And, you know, that's on the preventive side, you know, investing in youth and trying to keep them, you know, away from trouble. And I see the those investments pay off. But I have also seen, you know, individual and institutional tragedies where Black Americans disproportionately are victims from unjustified police violence. We have to do something about it. I thought in 2009, as a prosecutor in the office that prosecuted Oscar Grant's killer, that we would see a change in policing. And we have not. In fact, it's only gotten worse. And so not to say that, you know, all cops are bad. That's certainly not the case. But there's too many exceptions. And unless we make, you know, sweeping reforms through legislation, banning chokeholds, requiring a national database of bad cops, you know, reducing the standard to prove a civil rights violation, you know, getting rid of qualified immunity that protects police officers, you know, that do break the law. We have to do that so that Black Americans are treated equally under the law. But if that's all we do, Joseph, it will be insufficient because in every category, whether it's jobs, healthcare, access to education, Black Americans see fewer investments and fewer results than white Americans. And we have to close that gap too.
And how about defunding the police?
Yeah. So to me, we need to reimagine how we spend dollars in the community. And that's why I invoked my brother's work as essentially a community police officer. I would prioritize that over, you know, more, you know, militarized, you know, police equipment. I want the police, you know, to show up if there's a robbery in progress. I want the police, and every mother wants the police, you know, to take a drunk driver off the road. And no one that I know seriously believes that we would have a society where that does not happen. But, you know, budgets are statements of your values. And if you are over-investing in the police and not investing enough in schools and job training and healthcare, then I think you're going to need more police.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. If you have any questions for our guest, Congressman Eric Swalwell of the 15th Congressional District here in California, covers a lot of the East Bay. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So let's go back to the election and concerns, rising concerns that there is ongoing interference from Russia, perhaps interference from China, Iran. But most of the concern has been around Russia. What do you make of where we are when it comes to the security of our election from interference from abroad?
We have a president who welcomes foreign interference. We have a report from Special Counsel Mueller who said in 2016, candidate Trump, who asked the Russians to hack his opponent's emails, welcomed, planned for, and expected to benefit from what Russia was doing. And while, yes, you mentioned China and Iran, there is a monumental difference between what Russia is doing and what China and Iran are doing. And recently, I've seen efforts by the administration to conflate the threats so that you would believe that you should equally fear a snowstorm in the Rockies as much as you would fear a lightning storm in the Midwest and a Category 5 hurricane about to hit Florida. Russia is the only country that by capability, scope, and intent is trying to help one candidate, Donald Trump, and also at the same time trying to tear down his opponent, Joe Biden. And by the way, as we know, they have a prior. And so I believe the administration has tried to conflate and confuse the threats to the American people. While we may not be able to give the directives to the you know, brave men and women on the front lines at the FBI and CIA and NSA that they need to counter Russia disinformation, we can at least make sure the American people are aware of what the threat is. And we've been doing that with the majority in the House.
So barring the president and the Republicans holding Russia accountable at this point. What are the Democrats prepared to do, given that they only control one of the two houses, to protect this election from your point of view?
Thank you, Joseph, for pointing out. I mean, you know, we have the House, but the Republicans control the Senate, where, by the way, you know, Republican senators voted against recent sanctions against Russia. And of course, the White House, where it was reported this week that President Trump is seeking a meeting with Vladimir Putin before the election. No president of a country that is interfering or trying to steal our democracy deserves a meeting with the U.S. president before the election. And so, again, we can heighten the awareness as we go into, you know, a government funding showdown before the end of September. We can leverage the power of the purse to make sure as best we can we're funding, you know, directives that would counter Russia's interference. But we really need to make sure the American people can discern, you know, what is being laundered by Russia, you know, especially through the United States Senate in some of these investigations into Joe Biden, that it's clear it is Russia laundered propaganda, and make sure that they understand what's at stake in November.
What kind of directives would you fund?
Well, good question. And I'm going to be careful just considering, you know, my role on the committee. But I do believe we can maximize the sanctions against Russia and make them feel the pain. We can, you know, build consensus and a coalition with our allies who have also been victims of Russia's interference to also collectively have them, you know, bring a class action to prosecute the sanctions case against Russia. But we also have, you know, I believe, you know, different a menu of options that we could use to counter Russia disinformation. But it takes the president, you know, to really lead that charge. And I'm afraid we don't have that leadership right now.
Well, that brings me to your book that you published in June, Endgame, Inside the Impeachment of Donald J. Trump. While the president was impeached, he is still in office. And as you said, he is the only president to run for re-election after being impeached. What's your take on what happened there and what should have happened?
Well, the president used our taxpayer dollars to try and get a foreign government to help him cheat an election. And he essentially copped to it. You know, he had his hand caught in the cookie jar, released the call transcript with Ukraine's president, where he asked them to do us a favor, though, withheld the aid until Ukraine manufactured dirt on Biden. Now, while he was not removed from office, I do believe we set a standard for what presidents can and cannot do. So a future corrupt president could not say, well, you didn't impeach Donald Trump for this, so you can't impeach me. We did impeach him for being corrupt. And so I think that protects, you know, future legislators in their ability to hold a president accountable. But Joseph, Ukraine got the aid, by the way. You know, they had not received the aid until we launched the investigation. Once we launched the investigation, they received the aid with nothing changing in the reasons that the administration was giving for why they were holding it up. But also, I believe it has inoculated Joe Biden from spurious attacks against his character because we shined a light on what the president was doing. Now, I believe he should have been removed by the Senate, but now every voter in America has a chance to be a senator who can vote to remove the president.
And you speak a lot about the strategies and of the Democratic Party during the impeachment and how strategic, controlled the message was, and everyone was in lockstep, and yet it didn't get you what you were hoping for. What should have happened? What should have the Democrats done differently to have had the Senate actually remove the president?
Yeah, I think we are up against the Fifth Avenue problem, which is that for many Republicans, the president could shoot someone, you know, on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, as he, you know, joked as a candidate in 2016. And so in many ways, even had John Bolton had the courage to come forward and testify, and Mike Pompeo, if he had honored his subpoena, I'm still convinced that most Republicans would have done anything to protect the president. And it says more about those senators than us as American people, because I believe that just as we, you know, threw 41 members of Congress out to flip the House in 2018, you're going to see the Senate change hands this coming election, in large part because people believe that they just, you know, failed the test of leadership and what you do when confronted with corruption.
So the New York Times last week published an article saying that a former FBI official is planning to plead guilty to falsifying documents in the Russia probe, the Russian interference in the election. Do you think that leads credence to the Republican and the president's argument specifically that this whole Russia scandal was a hoax and that the Democrats were really just trying to, you know, get back at him for having won the election?
If a lawyer lied to the court, they should face the consequences for that. As I understand it, though, that lawyer, the lie that they made or the information they did not include or altered came well after the election. And so the president's claims that, you know, they were spying on his campaign, I believe this happened when he was president, to continue surveillance on somebody associated with the campaign. I could be wrong on that, but I thought that the alleged conduct occurred after Donald Trump was president. However, I read the Inspector General report about this lawyer, and they found that the different applications to surveil Trump campaign surrogates should have still been granted, even with the lawyer's misrepresentation. And so I get why the president would want to exaggerate this to make a larger point, but you know, maybe we should find the person who coerced Donald Trump in July 2016 to say publicly, Russia, if you're listening, you should get Hillary's emails, because like only Donald Trump said that. No one else said that. And I think there's overwhelming evidence that he did welcome their interference and planned a campaign around it.
In the last few minutes that we have in our conversation, I want to turn to the COVID pandemic. So we know that the Congress went into recess without coming up with further relief for Americans who are unemployed. Tell us, what does this say about our system, and what do you hope might change in the coming weeks to reverse this stalemate that we're at?
Well, you know, to any of your listeners who are unemployed or, you know, have a family member or friend unemployed, I'm sorry that you find yourself in this situation. You know, I have family members and friends in the same situation, and it's on my mind all the time. 2 weeks ago, I served meals or delivered meals at a drive-through food bank that was 2 hours long and met people who never imagined that they would be in a line like that, and encountered one woman who asked for one extra loaf of bread. And as I reached to give it to her, I was told by a volunteer that we can't do that. We need to make sure every car gets a loaf of bread. And so it's people like that who are counting on us to get it right and counting on us not to see a pandemic politicized for anyone's, you know, personal, you know, career gain. And so I do hope that the Heroes Act is enacted. Every day ringing in my ears, I hear the words of the Federal Reserve Chairman, who has said essentially, you can't spend enough to help the American people. And during a time like this, we should help everyone in need.
And so what is the Democratic strategy at this point to make this happen?
Keep telling the stories of the people in need. Stay at the negotiating table as long as possible, even if the president is off golfing. But have a plan in November if we don't get there, because as I said, in the first 100 hours, I hope we can pass and fulfill any gaps in what we passed in the Heroes Act.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us tonight, Congressman Eric Swalwell of the 15th Congressional District in California. Thanks for joining me, and enjoy the Democratic National Convention. Next up, we'll hear a conversation between Bay Area comedian Zara Norbash and City Vision's guest contributor, Sara Ladipo Manyika. Stay with us.
My name is Zara. I am a feminist, Muslim, Iranian-American comedian. Thank you! It doesn't always go that way. I say I'm Iranian. People get scared by this. I like to have fun with it. I like to sit in the front row of nuclear physics classes. Excuse me, professor. This plutonium. Can you find that on like the Craigslist? Excuse me, professor. When are we going to make a nuclear bomb?
So I wonder if you can talk about the challenges that stereotypes pose for comedians who bring diversity to the stage, such as yourself.
Yeah, I see so many comedians go different routes with stereotypes. And I did this sort of informal survey where I asked some comedians what they think a stereotype means. And some folks said that they thought a stereotype is a distillation of, you know, a whole community into one story. And some folks thought that a stereotype was an embarrassing truth, which I thought was really interesting. Myself, I don't think that either of those really accurately summarize what a stereotype is or does. I think that a stereotype is one frequently told narrative.
So then can I ask you if you think there is anything, if there's such a thing as universally funny?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's this sort of confusion around what is our shared experiences that we relate to and context we bring in versus sort of the specificity of social discourse that's out there. So like, for example, with the stereotype, if I could see how if a comedian thinks that it's an embarrassing truth about a community, that they would like release tension, right, by talking about it. And would perceive that as being funny and welcoming versus if it's a frequently told narrative that we don't need to hear again and again and again, then even just mentioning it, even to go a different route, is going to be frustrating, mm-hmm. right? When it comes to universal truths, the thing that I love about comedy is how much it reveals for us. I think it doesn't need to always be correct. I think there's always so many, there's so much focus on what's right or wrong. I think the honesty that sometimes comedy comes in with of what we do or don't laugh at is itself important. And sometimes what I see audiences do or comics do is say, well, I laughed and so therefore it's honest and so therefore it must be okay. And I think that's a lot of the problem with kind of our liberal discourse around what is or is not appropriate. That our intention may have been honest, our intention may have been good, it doesn't change the fact that it's causing harm.
Speaking of harm, we are experiencing social upheaval and a global pandemic right now. So what is funny in unfunny times, and how does this affect the content of your comedy?
Oh man, there's so much comedy right now just because there's so much pain and absurdity. There's so much that we're all coping with. You know, we just talked about shared identity, right? And universal truths. And definitely in the global experience of a pandemic, there's definitely this unifying experience of, you know, this adversity and this pain. And so absolutely, there's a lot of comedy to be had around that because that's how we survive.
Right. So, okay, well, how about the delivery of comedy then? Because I'm imagining that as a stand-up comedian, you must really be missing the energy of a live audience. So how are you managing without this?
It's been hard and also fascinating. I'm just so fascinated by it. Like, I don't know how else to explain. It just brought me so much joy in humanity that when the pandemic hit, I mean, I think it only took about a week or two before there were Zoom comedy shows online. I performed at a few and went to a few, and there were so many audiences.
So, okay, so let me probe a little bit more on this then, Zara, because your use of silence in your shows is brilliant. So how does silence work? And then how can it work in virtual spaces?
Okay, it's time to nerd. Is that what you're telling me? I'm a nerd.
Go for it.
So the theatricality of Zoom and the theatricality of comedy actually work really well together, because the pause in a joke is really about anticipation, generating a sense of anticipation. Mm-hmm. On Zoom, everybody is kind of leaned in the beginning, like, what is this? And what are we doing? And what's going to happen? And what's going to go wrong? All that tension works to the favor of a comedian. The trick is, like, then, you know, there's that adjustment period of, like, what's Wi-Fi and what's my comedic timing, you know? But, I mean, comics, that's why we perform, like, 7 nights a week, is for us to get a accurate gauge on what kind of anticipations mean different things. So I've just been watching different comics kind of play with that sense of anticipation of, like, is it the Wi-Fi? Is it all going to end? What if I get logged off? You know, and all that sense of leaning in actually works to our favor.
And I guess this phrase, you know, you're on mute, is, I can just imagine that can be something perhaps that is played with as well. That seems to be the thing that I hear more than anything else in the virtual space.
Oh my God. My favorite thing has been muting hecklers. It is so awesome. That's something you cannot do live that I've actually really enjoyed.
Uh-huh. Hey, Zara, let me turn and ask you about expanding the comedy pipeline. You've talked about expanding the comedy pipeline.
Yes.
How can this be done, and why is this important to you?
One of the challenges about the comedy pipeline and what kind of makes it a pipeline is that, regardless of how many alternative venues we perform at as comedians, at the end of the day, the big unifier, the big funnel, is the club comedy bar circuit. And that space can be really alienating to folks who either A, can't make it to the city to a bar at night, or, you know, don't like that environment because of racism, sexism, jokes that they don't want to sort of make themselves available to. There's also so many instances of club bouncers seating people of color up in the front to, you know, create an opportunity for the comedian to make jokes about them, about mixed couples. And so there are a lot of folks who don't attend. And what that does then is it shapes the comedian's material to the people who do attend.
So Zara, tell us what you're working on now, and when and where can people find it or access it?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm working on a book about all my stories. And I'm also working on a new solo show with Bushra Burney called The Kolfi Paradox. And it's hilarious and poignant and coming your way this October.
Well, Zara, thank you for joining us tonight. Zara Norbash. For more on Zara, go to zaracomedian.com.
That was Zara Norbash speaking to our guest contributor, Sara Ladipo-Manyika. Zara just wrapped up a 5-year run as the co-host of the acclaimed podcast Good Muslim, Bad Muslim that we heard at the beginning of this segment, and she'll be featured on an upcoming edition of CNN's United Shades of America with Kamau Bell. And that's it for City Visions this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Tonight's show is produced by Chris Nooney and Wendy Holcomb. Join us again next Monday at 6 when we look at race, class, and elections. This is Joseph Pache. Good night. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.